The invocation is from the Tao Te Ching. In dwelling, live close to the ground. In thinking, keep to the simple. In conflict, be fair and generous. In governing, don't try to control. In work, do what you enjoy. In family life, be completely present. The reading I have for today is from a Robert Fulghum book called All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. I've read it before in this pulpit, and if you're hearing it again, I hope you enjoy it enough to enjoy it with us. If you're hearing it for the first time, lucky day. Giants, wizards, and dwarfs was the game to play. Being left in charge of about 80 children, 7 to 10 years old, while their parents were off doing parenty things, I mustered my troops in the church social hall and I explained the game. It's a large-scale version of rock, paper, scissors and involves some intellectual decision-making. But the real purpose of the game is to make a lot of noise and run around chasing people until nobody knows which side you were on or who won. Now, organizing a room full of wired-up grade schoolers into two teams, explaining the rudiments of the game, and achieving consensus on group identity, all this is no mean accomplishment, but we did it with right goodwill, and we're ready to go. The excitement of the chase had reached a critical mass, and I yelled out, "You have to decide now what you are, a giant, a wizard, or a dwarf!" While the groups huddled in frenzied, whispered consultation, a tug came at my pants leg. A small child stands there looking up and asks in a small, concerned voice, "Where do the mermaids stand?" Where do the mermaids stand? A long pause. A very long pause. "Where do the mermaids stand?" says I. "Yes, you see, I am a mermaid." "Well, there are no such things as mermaids." "Oh, yes, I am one." She didn't relate to being a giant, a wizard, or a dwarf. No, she knew her category, mermaid. And she was not about to leave the game and go over and stand against the wall where a loser would stand. She intended to participate wherever mermaids fit into the scheme of things, without giving up dignity or identity. And she took it for granted that I would know where that place just was. Well, where do the mermaids stand? All the mermaids, all those who are different, who do not fit the norm, who do not accept the available boxes and pigeonholes. Answer that question, and you can build a school, a nation, or a world on it. What was my answer at the moment? Every once in a while, I say the right thing. "The mermaid stands right here by the king of the sea," says I. "Right here by the king's fool," was what I thought. So we stood there, hand in hand, reviewing the troops of wizards and giants and dwarfs as they rolled by in wild disarray. And it's not true, by the way, that mermaids do not exist. I know at least one personally, and I have held her hand. We'll now have 2 minutes of quiet music. Please feel free at this time to get up and light a candle if you wish. After the candle lighting, we'll have a prayer and then a moment of silence. The wisest person trusts the process without seeking to control, takes everything as it comes, lives not to achieve or possess, but simply to be all he or she can be in harmony with Tao. The meaning of success. The meaning of success. This morning, I offer you some thoughts about success and would like to start with our Unitarian superhero, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Now, you will recall that he championed the philosophy of transcendentalism that explores the mystical unity of nature. And while a book lover, Emerson urged independent thinking and stressed that not all of life's answers are found in books, and that a scholar learns best by engaging life He was a real mermaid, it seemed, or merman, if you like. Emerson suggests to laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to leave the world a little better place, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition. To know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is the meaning of success. Well, let's take a look at these pieces of Emerson's success model and see if these principles from a man born in 1803 can apply to those of us living in 2004. It's worth a try. To laugh often and much. According to an article from the University of Iowa Health Science Relations, laughter recently got a boost when researchers announced at the American Heart Association meeting last November that heart-healthy people are more likely to laugh frequently. Dr. Nicole Nisley said they are more likely to use humor to soothe over difficult situations. She continues, exactly how laughter contributes to your health isn't entirely understood, but evidence suggests that laughter may result in a reduction of stress hormones, leading to a reduction in blood pressure, and that in turn may reduce the risk of heart disease. Yet the benefits of laughter go beyond heart disease. Laughter has been found to decrease tension, reduce pain. It also appears to boost the body's production of infection-fighting antibodies. And laughter even has the potential to help in the treatment of depression and other emotional illnesses. So apparently Emerson was on to something here. But here's the rub. I've read some of Emerson's writings. So have you. I've read Nature and The Transcendentalist, and honestly, I don't see the laughter. For a man to propose as the very first element of success to laugh often and much, I would have thought his writings would offer, oh, just a wee bit more lightheartedness. That sometimes is the Unitarian way, though, isn't it? Serious, somber, intellectual passion, very, very little humor. Well, with all due respect to our dear merman, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Jeff Foxworthy, I love to laugh, and I love to laugh often. I offer these thoughts to you this morning. If you think the phrase, Jesus saves, refers to a banking philosophy, you might be a Unitarian. If your idea of a religious crusade is to wear a button that reads, a mind is like a parachute, it doesn't work unless it's open, you might be a Unitarian. If you believe that the Da Vinci Code is almost all nonfiction, you might be a Unitarian. If you have a car with a bumper sticker that reads, give me that old-time religion and a picture of Stonehenge, you might be a Unitarian. And lastly, if you are just torn between participating in the winter solstice festivities, the Hanukkah party, the Kwanzaa gathering, or the Christmas tree lighting ceremony, then you most certainly might be a Unitarian. It is good to laugh. And Emerson is right that laughter and joy enhance our lives. Now, his second offering is to win the respect of intelligent people. And I submit to you Jane Goodall. I'm sure many of you know her as that lanky blonde woman who sits with a clipboard in hand studying chimpanzees in Africa. Well, what's so compelling about Jane Goodall is that the beginning of her career was marred by disdain and controversy. She went to Africa at 23 years old to work for Louis Leakey, the famed paleontologist, anthropologist, in any capacity. With very little formal training, he was so impressed with her that he sent her to Gombe to observe the chimpanzees there. After 3 short months, she saw a significant and monumental event. A large male chimp, she named David, was pushing a grass stem into a hole in order to retrieve termites for a snack. He made and he used a tool. This was huge. This was huge because it was widely accepted theory that man was the only tool maker and user on the planet. Goodall writes, "My observations at Gombe challenged human uniqueness, and whenever that happens, there's always a violent scientific and theological uproar. On this occasion, there were some who tried to discredit my observations because I was untrained, and therefore could not possibly produce reliable information. But the photographs I eventually obtained proved the truth. Well, some scientists then actually suggested I must have taught the chimps to fish for termites. The result of it all, however, was that it was deemed necessary to redefine man in a more complex manner than before. Heaven forbid we should lose any aspect of our human uniqueness." Goodall returned to England in 1964 and earned a PhD from Cambridge, then began teaching at Stanford University, continuing to return to Gombe and her chimpanzee research for most of her life. Now, at 70 years old, Jane Goodall's life's work is amazing. Her findings and research have changed our relationships with chimpanzees and other animals. In addition, the institute that bears her name supports research and conservation projects involving all wildlife in Africa and works to improve the conditions of animals in captivity and to raise awareness and understanding of these issues with as wide an audience as possible. She travels and lectures over 300 days a year and has received numerous awards and recognitions. Clearly, she has earned the respect of intelligent people. Now on to the affection of children. Olga Masters writes, "Many people have said to me, 'What a pity you had such a big family to raise. Think of the novels and the short stories and the poems you never had time to write because of that.' And I look at my children and I say, 'These are my poems. These are my short stories.'" This church understands the affection for children creates a happy, healthy place for people of all ages. The spirit of community abounds here, and its origin might be the youthful energy that's apparent when one walks in the door. If you walked in the door this week, there was a whole lot of youthful energy as Camp UU took over. And if you have a moment when you see Emily Weddington, you should give her a full body hug for the work she did. There were a number of other fabulous volunteers this week, but Emily really took the load and carried it in an outstanding way. It's nice to know our church is in such good, youthful, I'll bet sticky, hands. We need another example of someone who understands success is connected to the affection of children. We can certainly look to Jim Henson. Again, almost everyone here probably has an image of that bearded puppeteering guy doing Kermit the Frog. But Jim Henson was, like Jane Goodall, a complex person and a significant contributor to the milieu of the 21st century. Yes, he reinvented puppetry because before his arrival, there was Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, and that's about it. He threw out that tiny little proscenium stage, and he created characters with depth and humor. His contribution to Sesame Street alone is colossus. And he led a team of artists that have shaped our world and our children's world with kindness and love. Jim Henson was also behind The Muppet Show, The Muppet Movies, experimental films like The Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, and my favorite, The Storyteller Series. He pushed his team to move beyond felt and ping pong ball eyes and embrace technology to produce great art. The Storyteller programs are the only entertainments to use live performers, puppets, and animation to tell a story. And he did all of this while speaking to children with respect and dignity. Another nice piece about the Jim Henson story is that his own five children adored him and are all actively involved in the family business in some way. Thoreau said, "If a man does not keep pace with his companions, perhaps it is because he hears a different drummer. Let him step to the music, which he hears, however measured or far away." And I think Jim Henson understood this. To leave the world a little better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition, is next. A healthy child. Henry and Nanny Delaney had 10 of them. Amy Harth writes in the foreword to Having Our Say, a biography of Sarah and Elizabeth Delaney, two of their daughters who lived well into their 100s, Henry Delaney was born into slavery, but eventually became the first elected Negro bishop of the Episcopal Church. All 10 of his children were college-educated professionals at a time when few Americans, black or white, ever went beyond high school. The Delaney Creed centered on self-improvement through education, civic-mindedness, and ethical living, along with a strong belief in God. The family motto was, "Your job is to help somebody." According to Bessie and Sadie Delaney, this code applied to anyone who needed help, regardless of color, and their accomplishments could not shield them from discrimination and the pain of racism, but they held themselves to high standards of fair-minded idealism. It was Jacqueline Kennedy who said, "If you bungle raising your children, I don't think whatever else you do well matters very much." A garden patch. Well, with Emerson's love of nature, it's easy to see why he would include this in his definition. And I want to bring your attention to a wonderful extension of this idea. DUG, D-U-G, Denver Urban Gardens. It's a nonprofit organization that operates and assists with the creation and management of over 70 metro area community gardens and small parks in and around Denver, Colorado. Primarily serving low to moderate income populations in urban neighborhoods, DUG provides opportunities for participants to supplement their diet with produce grown in nearby public gardens. Through the gardens, participants assume responsibility to improve their community, initiate a sense of pride in their surroundings, and improve their nutritional status through healthy, fresh food. Emerson would be thrilled, I think. To leave the world a little better with a redeemed social condition. Well, clearly, the founders of the Denver Urban Gardens are doing this. And another incredible organization, a little closer to my heart, is worth mentioning here as well. Half the Skies Foundation's mission is to enrich the lives and enhance the prospects for the babies and children in China who wait to be adopted, and for those who will spend their childhoods in orphanages. Founded by American Jenny Bowen after she adopted her daughter from China, this organization establishes early childhood education, personalized learning and infant nurture programs in China's welfare institutions to provide the children stimulation, individual attention, and an active learning environment. Currently, Half the Sky has 16 centers in China, impacting thousands of lives. And it's growing and expanding as I speak, and the value of it is profound and unbelievably life-changing. Finally, we have arrived at Emerson's last point. To know one life has breathed easier because you have lived. Wow. This is powerful. In 1991, one of my beloved students was injured in a car accident that took her father's life. Rita was in a coma for 4 months and had a difficult recovery, having to relearn most of her speech and the physical basics of daily life. She was different after the accident. She spoke more slowly, often in simple Taoistic phrases. Once, she assured me in her thoughtful manner that my life was going to be better. And I was unaware that she even knew about my difficulties. For you see, it was, to say the least, an exceedingly challenging time for me as I was struggling with the direction of my life, my marriage, my world entire. A year and 3 months after the accident, Rita probably had a seizure and she died in a head-on car collision. I was devastated. I wasn't alone. Her funeral overflowed with people trying to comfort her poor mother and her young brother. And at her funeral, I remember being reminded of the lesson that life is so delicate. I decided that day to make bold, sweeping changes that my heart wanted. Well, now, years later, it seems obvious that these were the right choices for me. Several days after Rita's funeral, her very best friend, Anjali, gave me a copy of a poem Rita had written a year before the original accident for their AP English class. I want to share this with you. Just indulge me. Walking upon the hot, sparkling sands, I feel the rough grains. Each individual one sifts through my toes, as do the sands of time. Ceaselessly, they pound in and pound out with the eternal cycle of the lustrous moon. Walking upon the hot, sparkling sands, I feel the wind swirl round and round my true being, endeavoring to bear my soul over the endless pounding and beyond the shining moon, with only the cumbersome body of my soul remaining. May the wind succeed in capturing my soul, for then, and only then, where my soul soar swiftly into the worlds far beyond ours and transcend the doleful, disordered grains. This life breathes easier because Rita lived. And even though she was 19 years old, she helped many of us transcend the doleful, disordered grains. Her life was most certainly a success. So I made the changes in my life. I have no regrets after at all. Rita's death pushed me into action. And 12 years later, I'm living in Austin, Texas with my partner, and we are adopting a baby girl from China. And in that beautiful chaos of the first year of parenting, I glaze over and I can't remember the exact date of Rita's passing. I usually mark it with meditation or I connect with the other teacher who loved her just as much as I did. But last year, I was fuzzy. And I went off in search of my journal to look up the date, which turned out to be March 6. March 6, my daughter's birthday. If you Google the meaning of success into your computer, you will find a bazillion hits regarding money and other reflections of our capitalistic society. Yes, most people might define success by the size of your house, your car, your paycheck, your boat. But some of us know it's far more spiritual than that. All of those who are different, who do not fit the norm, who do not accept the available boxes and pigeonholes. We define success by how much we connect with other people, by the interaction of our real and sacred community, and by an earnest effort to make this world a better place for everybody. Susan Sarandon said, "At the end of your life, what you're going to want to know is that you made some kind of difference." The meaning of success: to laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to leave the world a little better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition. To know one life has breathed easier because you have lived. Thank you, Ralph Waldo Emerson. We'll try.